Good morning. My name is Daniel Serwer. I'm the Vice President for Peace and Stability Operations here at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And it's a pleasure to welcome you to this session on Ground Truth from Iraq, Politicians, Police, and Pacification. We resurrected the pacification word, obviously, for the occasion from 30 or 40 years ago when it was quite common during the war in Vietnam. Let me ask you all to turn off your cell phones. We have a panel this morning of initial speakers, each of whom will take 10, 15 minutes in their presentations, that is not only distinguished, but has a great deal of experience on the ground in Iraq, and that's why we refer to ground truth. We're still measuring experience in Iraq in months, but Major Ben Connable has 16 months of, combat experience in Iraq. Matt Sherman has 26 months as a civilian in Iraq, which is also combat experience. And Phoebe Marr tells me that I should either count 50 years or 8 weeks. We have our choice. 50 years of working on Iraq and 8 weeks that she spent while being a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace in Iraq. I think we'll start with Phoebe, maybe move to Matt, and finish with Ben. Phoebe, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Well, it's nice to be here again. I came back a couple of weeks ago from a two-week trip. Unfortunately, from my perspective, it was all in the green zone because it's so difficult to get out. But as you may or may not know, I'm working on a study of the newly emerging leadership in Iraq. And so I was there, of course, to get interviews with and assess the new cabinet, the new parliament, and was there during the time that they were meeting and hence had plenty of access to many of them. And so what I'd like to do this morning is to give you not only give you my impressions, but to give you the preliminary data on my study, which is an update on the last tranche, which came at the end of 2005 on the new leaders, what the new cabinet seems to tell us about trends, and even give you a few preliminary figures, although I caution you these figures are not entirely complete. They're going to be refined, but they're certainly in many cases clear enough to indicate the trends. So let me start, since I don't have too much time, with some conclusions. In terms of this new cabinet and government, which as we know is supposed to be permanent, that is for 4 years, although of course there will be some internal changes in it. I think what you see now is what you're going to get. I think there are going to be few surprises in the future, possibly with the exception of some controversies over the Constitution. There may be more Sunnis in time, hopefully added to the mix, but I think the assessment we make of the current situation is likely to persist into the future. This is what we should expect, and I think this situation in Iraq is all about managing expectations. The situation is either going to gradually improve or it's gradually going to deteriorate, depending on our policy, whether we have a smart policy and are willing to stick to it, and on the development of Iraqi pragmatism. Now, let me make a couple of key points about what I find, and I have a few statistics to back it up, on the new government leadership. With the exception of the Kurds, who, of course, have had lots of experience in the past 15 or 20 years, this leadership is inexperienced. It's not used to running a government, running a cabinet, and so on, and it's going to have an intense learning curve. We need to get our expectations wrapped around that. One of the striking things in looking at this leadership from 2003 and even from the last cabinet to this one is the discontinuity. The turnover in each government since 2003 has been very high. And the turnover from the last one we had And this one, for example, is 76%. And when I checked with the turnover in the last one here, I found it was 63% over the last one. So it's increasing. This is new leadership that has not actually had experience governing. The second dimension that I've been following and is important is the insider-outsider dimension. Those figures who were outside of Iraq for a decade or two, particularly the last decade before Saddam fell, either because they were opposition, mainly because they were opposition, they couldn't stand his regime, they were working outside for one reason or another. Included in that mix, I would put the Kurds, who since 1991-92 were operating in the north virtually free of Saddam's control. Insiders are those who were inside Iraq working one way or another under Saddam's regime. This dimension is still there. That is to say that a large percentage of the leaders in government are outsiders or Kurds who are in the north. Again, let me give you the figures here. While there's still a large unknown factor I'm not sure about, at least 30% of the leaders, especially at the top, are outsiders. 15% more were Kurds who were in the north. So 45% are sort of outsiders. Only about 26% are insiders. This means the people who were inside Iraq under Saddam, and in particular, those who were in the Ba'ath or had to accept the Ba'ath or work under the Ba'ath, are not in the leadership positions yet. Now, the most important thing that struck me about the leaders this time, again, it's not new, but the figures show it, and my impressions in conversation show it. What is shaping up here is oppositionists versus the old regime. Now, this, of course, doesn't sound new, but it seems to be intensifying. By this, I mean people in one way or another who've spent the last 10, 15, 20 years of their lives in some way or other in opposition to the regime. Obviously, that overlaps with outsiders. Many of these were in the religio-political parties in Iran or in other countries in the Middle East. Of course, there's a whole contingent that was in the West that we're aware of. The Kurds, I fit into that category because most of them were up in the north and in opposition. Some few were actually inside Iraq. People in the Iraqi Islamic Party, for example, who got in trouble with the regime, got put in prison. The number of people who hold up prison time as a badge is very important. I would say ex-Ba'athists, but the people who had some affiliation with Saddam. This does not necessarily mean those at the top of his structure, but people who worked in the bureaucracy, who worked in the military, who had some affiliation with the party because you couldn't work inside Iraq without it, and were in one way or another shaped by the old regime. These people have not yet been included in the structure. And thereby hangs the tale, because while we have got Sunnis, we've got political parties who ran, they were the ones who were actually somewhat in opposition. And as you tail off from people who are in the IIP, the Iraqi Islamic Party, over to the rest of that Tawafiq group, you get academics, you get others who had affiliations with the regime, and they really aren't yet incorporated. Then, of course, you get to Salah Mutlaq, who was an ex-Ba'athist, who did get some Ba'athist votes, and while he did get elected to parliament, he is not included in the cabinet. So that is, in my view, one of the big challenges, the whole issue of de-Ba'athification. And when you talk to the leaders, you see that they feel that their new government is still fragile. They worry about the old Sunnis coming into the military and perhaps making a coup. They worry about what kind of reconciliation program you can have with the Ba'ath. And then when you go on the other side and you talk to the ex-Ba'athists, they say, look, we're willing to participate, we want to run, but every time we put our name forward, we're excluded, not because we were in the Ba'ath, we weren't, but because we're Sunnis. So there is still a great deal of misunderstanding and distrust to overcome here. And last but not least, the structure of this government, as we know, is a national unity government. It's designed to be inclusive and encourage stakeholders. But I think we all have to be aware that there's a trade-off here, that getting consensus is going to take a lot of time and be difficult, and therefore you're not going to get a lot of decisive action. So it's going to be a trade-off between a government that's able to be decisive. Everybody keeps looking for the strong leader. Stop looking. He isn't there. But the trade-off is going to have to be to get consensus. Everyone seems to agree that this new government, you can measure progress by the way in which this new government does several things. It needs, that is to say, particularly Prime Minister Maliki, who's from the Dawa party, needs to move beyond parties. You can't say this is a Dawa government. The people I trust are Dawa. I don't trust those other guys. He's got to speak for Iraq and Iraqis and have a more inclusive tone. He is doing this, I think, incidentally. In all the ministries, you need to be moved beyond this ministry is my patrimony. There has to be a broad civil service that develops, and the ministry has got to stop being a fief. There needs to be an overarching cabinet, or at least a portion of the cabinet which can come together and agree on some kind of policy and direction. And last but not least, I think this is where we in the West could help. Everyone agrees that these inexperienced ministers who really have not run a government before need good staffing. What is happening to the middle class, the professional, educated, technocratic elite who can run a ministry, get the electricity on, and so forth? This is the big question here. Many of them are leaving because of the security situation. Those that are there are looking around for a home where they feel comfortable and safe. And a footnote here is that, of course, the secular elite ran in parties such as Iraqiya, Alawi's party. These people are virtually out. They have no constituency, no ability to really win a substantial portion of the electorate. Some of them are in the cabinet, some of them are in parliament, but they're going to play a modest role at best. And their party leaders, Alawi, Chalabi, most people are counting out now. Where are they going to go? Interestingly, I found them looking around for what looked like the most stable party for the future, Sidi. The Majlis-e-Ala, the party of Adil Abdul Mehdi, many of them were attaching themselves to this party. Maybe this will happen with other parties as well, and gradually they can professionalize some of these ministries. I'm running out of time, so let me just throw out just a couple of other ideas, which I can substantiate with statistics. Everyone's talking about the big ethnic and sectarian blocs, the Shia, the Kurds, the Sunnis. What I'm finding is that these are now breaking down into more specific groups, specifically political parties. And it seems to me, this is hopeful, that the complexity of Iraq is beginning to come through. For example, the Shia United Iraqi Alliance is breaking up. The rivalry between the main political groups, if you sit in any parties or receptions, is very clear. The city folks who consider themselves really the dominant political party in Iraq today really don't speak very well of the Dawa, who is their, one of their main competitors, certainly in charge of the prime ministership. The Sudrists, they're more of a movement than a real party, and in thereby hangs a tale as well. Very interesting. They're entering the mainstream. Nobody thinks very highly of them or their candidates in the ministries. Nevertheless, they're a factor to be taken account of. And we have also Fadila, which is a main party in Basra and able to exercise some influence there, and a number of independents, such as Shahristani, the new oil minister, who is said to be close to Sistani, who, of course, plays a role behind the scenes as well. The Kurds are more united than others. That's very clear, especially vis-a-vis the Iraq issue. But here, too, I think we should watch for some differentiation between Kurds who are playing a role in the central government. And believe me, when you look at this continuity, it's fascinating, because the ones who really have the continuity, who hang on to those central government ministries, who have the experience, are Kurds. Jalal Talabani, Hushar Zebari, Barham Saleh, even Narmin Uthman, a woman. Cabinet after cabinet, they're there. So, of course, they acquire the experience. These people who are in the central government may be developing a broader constituency, a broader view, and maybe a little more realistic situation of where the Kurds could, should go in Iraq. Those that are up in the north, more likely the KDP and Barzani, especially the prime minister up there, Nesrivan, are much more centered in the Kurdish area and really invested in the north. Last but not least, the Sunnis. I see them. I had some very good interviews with them, both in Amman, with Farah Kashimi in the government. They're still a weak third in the government equation. The new groups in power are as yet untried. It's not clear how strong a constituency they have. Tawafiq is essentially the Iraqi Islamic Party, which is a solid party with a base, and then a whole group of others, intellectuals, tribal leaders, and one group or another, who are floating in and out, who do not have much cohesion. And then, as I've indicated, Salah Mutlaq's coalition, which is essentially ex-Ba'athists. Unless they can solidify, unless they can bring more Sunnis in, they're going to be, I still think, in a weak position on these negotiating postures on the Constitution and elsewhere. Let me conclude by saying we all know the central government is weak. One of the points that I want to make is one could talk about how things are going in the central government, some positives, some negatives, but I question how much strength this central government has outside Baghdad and the Green Zone. The Kurds are on their own in the north. Anbar is in revolt. One sheikh told me that he's trying to busy getting a northern Anbar province together with sheikhs to apply as a region, which I thought was a very interesting thought. The South is going to see a real struggle for power, hopefully political rather than military, among all these Shia groups. Certainly the Badr Brigade and Siri, the Sadrists, Fadila, and perhaps Sistani coming into the bargain as well. And if you look at a province like Hilla, where I talked to one of the people that's down there, Hilla is supposed to be a well-run province, you get this feeling that this national political structure that's being built with these political parties is now being superimposed on the provincial council, which is elected. The government, that is to say, the police, the people who collect the garbage, who keep the local government going, do have some contacts with the central government, would like to run a more merit-based civil service, but they're constantly being interfered with by the political politicians. For example, they were supposed to have something like 1,300 police hired in Hilla, and the party that won there was mainly Siri. They came in and said, well, we will appoint these 1,300. The head of the police there said, no, you won't. This is going to be by application, and merit will apply. It was a long bargaining process, and they cut the difference in half. Siri got to appoint about 700. The rest were appointed by merit. So in the central government, compromise is going to be necessary, not only among the ethnic and sectarian groups, all that has to be balanced, but now between and among the political parties. And so, as I say, we're going to have to be very patient because this is going to be time-consuming, and people who want a decisive step forward on amnesty, on de-Ba'athification, are going to have to wait. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Phoebe. Seems to me you've laid the groundwork beautifully for Matt Sherman to talk a bit about the Interior Ministry, police, and related matters.
Thank you, Daniel. I also want to thank USIP for inviting me here today. It's good to see lots of faces I've come across before, particularly Ambassador Simonai, who I've worked with in Iraq for a number of months. A lot of my comments will really complement what Phoebe has raised, particularly dealing with managing expectations, dealing with the divisiveness among the Shia parties, and also dealing with the weakness of the central government, and then also put forward some ideas on how we might be able to move forward. But to start off with, it's managing expectations. And the expectations that Prime Minister Maliki has set for himself have been quite high, but he's also come out of the box very strong. It's come out of the box by having that approximately 2,500 individuals released, detained release program, the National Reconciliation Program, announcing that Monthana province will be the first province transferred to Iraqi security control, and then also taking action with regards to the Baghdad security plan. So he's coming out of the box very, very strong, in my opinion. But I think he has to do this because he recognizes that the Iraqi public is only going to give him a short period of time in order to prove himself. So he knows he needs to have a string of successes early on in order to establish some type of legitimacy, in order to kind of shift some power back to the central government as opposed to the provinces. And this all goes to, I think this finally kind of really kind of hit home for him when he took his first significant trip outside of Baghdad. And this happened back in late May 31st, actually, when we went to Basra. And this was, and I've talked with the members of staff, a real eye-opening trip for the Prime Minister, in the sense of him finally recognizing, seeing firsthand, the limits of his power and what types of difficulties and challenges he would have over the coming of his tenure as Prime Minister. And what he saw when he down there was a very tenuous security situation. Basra has always kind of been, not necessarily in the headlines, because what we read about is car bombs going off all the time in Sunni areas or in Baghdad or up in Mosul and Tlaib or Fallujah. But Basra is, in my opinion, going to be the greatest challenge for this Prime Minister over his term as Prime Minister. One, because of the political situation there, and also two, because of this simmering type of security situation that can really flare up at any moment and has before in the past. Let me just start off by giving you a situation of what type of political divisiveness Phoebe mentioned about and also is on the ground there in Basra. You have a situation where you have the governor there being a member of the Fadila party. You have a provincial council which is split more or less between Skiri and also Fadila. And in order to get anything done, you need a two-thirds majority. You've got a police chief there who more or less was imposed by the coalition. And you have a rank and file of the police that are primarily Sabres. And all of these individuals don't like one another. And we've seen problems before in the past where they've lashed out against the British, where they've lashed out against themselves over the course of the past year to 2 years. What you also have is a situation where the provincial council there doesn't want any interference from the central government. I think the provincial council saw the Prime Minister's trip down to Basra as a challenge, as an affront to them, as interference in their own type of sovereignty down in Basra. And this kind of really kind of rattled them. Because the problem that the central government has always faced, and is again one that I think the Prime Minister is starting to recognize, is that he doesn't have the ability to kind of go into Basra and impose order. The only thing that he really has the ability to do is impose a state of emergency, which he did 3 days afterwards, where he imposed a month-long state of emergency with imposing curfews, with then also kind of sending down the military and stuff like that. But he shouldn't have to be able to do this. He should be able to have other types of tools in his arsenal, I guess you could say, in order to impose order there. But he doesn't. Because what we've done back during the CPA and things that such was that we really decentralized, we really neutered in many ways the central government. And this happened primarily through CPA Order 71. This was a big issue for me and then for all the Ministry of Interior in Baghdad. And during the regime, the ministry used to have a great deal of power, at least bureaucratically, maybe not with regards to its forces, but bureaucratically, where it used to be able to name governors, where it used to be able to name chiefs of police, where it really had a direct control and then could deal with security in certain areas where they flared up. That was then taken away. Now, the purpose of it being taken away was actually good. The policy behind it, or the theory behind CPA Order 71 to kind of take these powers away, was so that you don't create another totalitarian state. And that's a very admirable goal. You don't want to create that. But what the effect of it, at so early in the country's rebirth, was that really you gave too much power too quickly after the provinces, before the central government would be able to establish itself from a security perspective. I like to say that before you have Jefferson, you must first have Hobbes, in the sense that before you have a representative government, you must make sure that government has a monopoly on power. And that's always been what the problem is with this government and with the subsequent governments before, is that they've never been able to have that monopoly on power. And as a result, you have all these security forces that are around the country, particularly the police, that are kind of going out and acting independently. We always talk about the 135,000 police that will be trained, and there's been, I think, about 100,000 or so that have been trained equipped. They've gone through various 8 or 10 week courses. But what's difficult with this number is that more or less what it is that we've been training and equipping provincial security or local security forces, not necessarily security forces that are answerable to the central government. And this is a problem. And this is a problem that's being exacerbated down in Basra and in other cities as well. So what do you do to kind of move forward and try to... The genie's already out of the bottle. Some could say the bottle's already been broken. And so to kind of shift power back into Baghdad, back into the Ministry of Interior, back into the central government, is that you need to kind of, in my mind, establish a security force that's within the Ministry of Interior that deals with a number of critical issues on a nationwide scale, where they would deal with major crimes, where they would deal with smuggling, where they deal with mass killings, where they deal with the growing drug trade, where they deal with corruption, where they deal with a possible militia integration policy. And right now, that isn't there. There used to be an element within Baghdad called the Major Crimes Unit, which dealt with these issues and dealt with them well. But they got overwhelmed because they were a small group of individuals, and really the level type of crime that was started to proliferate within Baghdad overwhelmed them. And then eventually they then got gutted for other political reasons, unfortunately. But what you need to do is have a force like this, not like the commandos. We read a lot about the commandos, the national police that are out there. The national police were something that was created by Minister Fall al-Nakib, where he was trying to establish some type of paramilitary unit in order to deal with the security problems of the day. And those security problems remain, but the main security problem that faces the country, in my viewpoint, or the growing one, is crime. It's major crimes. It's smuggling. It's corruption. And that's the type of issue that needs to be addressed. And it won't be addressed by the national police because, again, they're a paramilitary unit. And they're not going to be addressed by the regular police because, really, there's no way of imposing any type of central control, any type of central policies, or any type of central direction in order to achieve those goals. Being able to kind of create another force similar, and not exactly because it would have to be an Iraqi creation, but similar to our FBI that would have jurisdiction in order to kind of go out throughout the country and focus on those areas, I think is critical in order for the central government to again start to shift back some of the power that these provinces are currently waging. Will they be able to do it? I don't know. I think that will be a central key that this prime minister will always face as he moves forward in his prime ministership. It'll be something that, if he doesn't address shortly, it'll be something that undermines his legitimacy. I think people want to see this government succeed, but again, they're not going to give it a full 4 years in order to start showing that. They're going to need to start showing results quickly, and they're trying to. But if you're not able to kind of gain control, Basra is going to flare up. The political situation there is going to be incredibly divisive, and you're going to see Basra become another situation that you're seeing in Baghdad and in other cities. I'll conclude there, and I'll be able to talk about other situations about the police and about the security situations in the Q&A. Thanks.
Thank you, Matt. Major Ben Campbell spent his recent months in Iraq in Ramadi, and will bring us some insights from that experience as well as other tours.
And wound up in Fallujah there. I started out in Ramadi and wound up in Fallujah. Just thank you for having me. It's always an honor to be here. Certainly to sit on a panel with Matt and Phoebe. We widely recognize Dr. Marr as the real expert on Iraq here. We have for quite some time in the military, and we continue to do so. So that, again, it's quite an honor. And I also like to say that here I am, a U.S. Marine with a shaved head at the U.S. Institute of Peace. That's a good thing. We probably need more of that. I can tell you from personal experience in Al-Anbar province that we don't have enough cooperation between the military, our civilian agencies, and our independent civil agencies. Needs to be improved. We need to get more folks out there. There's a lot of billets that are going unfilled in the State Department and elsewhere, especially out in Al-Anbar province, which open revolt. Yeah, it's not a peaceful place. I spent over a year in Al-Anbar, and I spent several months also going up through the country up in Tikrit. I spent 6 months that year in Al-Anbar dealing with tribal sheikhs, dealing with the governor, and supporting the division commander as his cultural advisor, and then spent the last 6 months pretty much trying to figure out the insurgency. With the short amount of time that I've got, I want to really focus in on the insurgency, but first I want to lay out why Al-Anbar is important. I know I'm giving you kind of a micro view here. Al-Anbar is not representative necessarily of the entire country, but it is critical in its own right. It's a massive section of the country as far as territory goes. It's about a third of the entire land space of the country. Although there's only about 1.5 million folks living in El Anbar, you've got some of the major cities that have a history of supporting insurgency in the country. Fallujah and Ramadi, if you know the history of El Anbar province, those have been the hot spots, and they continue to be the hot spots. El Anbar is also the direct conduit from Syria and Jordan into Baghdad. So there's a lot of discussion. It goes back and forth even amongst military folks. Why do we really need to keep El Anbar secure? Why do we need to invest all this time and effort? Why do we need to put all these troops in an area where we really don't have a lot invested economically, politically? It doesn't seem like people want to participate in the government until recently. What are we getting out of this? I can tell you that whatever happens in El Anbar feeds directly into Baghdad, and not just economically. The insurgency, the heart of the insurgency, is in El Anbar province, the Sunni insurgency, because this is a Sunni insurgency. I know that's been said before, but it remains true. Ramadi, Fallujah, and a lot of the cities along the western Euphrates River Valley, this is where it's all taking place. And if you lose that, if you give that away, you lose the conduit from Syria and Jordan into the heart of the country, into the heart of Iraq. You give over territory to people that are intent on overthrowing the government. And if you give them a safe haven, that's certainly what will happen. So I would say that from our perspective, El Anbar is not an area we can afford to lose. We cannot afford to pay short shrift as we've been doing. I can count on one hand the number of State Department and USAID personnel currently working on El Anbar, and I don't think it's ever been higher than that, which is shocking. Even under the CPA, we had three folks out there for the entire province. So we are underrepresented. I want to talk a little bit about the potential in El Anbar. This is one of the only homogeneous areas in the country. It is almost entirely Sunni. We estimate about 3% Shia. There is no civil war. There is no basis for civil war in El Anbar province. The Sunni in El Anbar province are surprisingly willing to support Shia candidates. As a matter of fact, the most popular political candidate remains Alawi, a Shia. So there is potential there to create something, to create a stable platform, a stable base for future political development that we have not tapped, because the focus, of course, remains in Baghdad, and I think rightfully so. But it's we forget all these opportunities at our peril. I want to talk a little bit about the insurgency in general, and again, this is an El Anbar-based insurgency. I've spent a great deal of time studying it, and as both Matt and Phoebe know, as you go back and forth to Iraq, you tend to go through phases. You see Iraq, the insurgency, as distinct groups. You see them as a unified group. You see Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Then you don't really see any structure at all, and you go back and forth, and you really can't pin it down. That's where I am now. I think after studying this for quite some time, there is no structure. I think we have imposed a structure on the insurgency that does not exist. That includes Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That includes the former Ba'athists. All the assumptions that we made about the Ba'ath Party, the former Ba'athists, the Republican Guard folks running the insurgency, the Saddamists, we broke them into very neat groups, Saddamists, AQI, and the jihadists inside the country. Those groups don't exist. In name only. There is a structure there. The structure does not impose much will on the actions of the insurgency on a day-to-day basis. I would argue that you could remove that structure from the mid to high level tomorrow, and you would continue to see the same number of attacks the next day. The insurgency is a symptom of the underlying conditions in that country more than it is anything else. It is not a movement. It is not an organization. It is not an insurgency as we see it in the traditional sense. As you know, the broadest comparisons are Malaya and Vietnam. There's a fantastic book by Lieutenant Colonel John Noggle, Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife. He compares both Malaya and Vietnam to Iraq. I'd argue that although we can certainly have lessons to learn from those two counterinsurgency operations, neither of the underlying political, cultural, or economic situations is comparable whatsoever. This has become a criminal activity, perhaps more so than an insurgent movement. The criminal activity tied in with the insurgency and has been from day one, has overtaken a great part of a vast majority of the motivation of the insurgents themselves. I would say that we have now gotten to a point where criminal financing, criminal behavior, criminal benefit is now the primary motivation of the majority of the insurgents, certainly in Al-Anbar province, and I'd argue probably in the rest of Iraq as well. That means a couple of things for us. It means that that structure does not exist. Again, these criminals will act and behave on their own in small cells, in small groups, in larger groups when they can move together, in connections that we don't see. General James Mattis, the former head of the 1st Marine Division, commanding general of the 1st Marine Division, said we only see between 5% and 10% of what's going on outside the wire from our bases at any one time. I'd say probably closer to 5%. That means we don't understand the structure. I would say that the insurgents themselves don't understand their own structure. That includes AQI, the AQI cover group, the Mujahideen Shura Council, and all the other organizations that you've heard named. They are criminal enterprises. That does not take away from the belief in jihad. That does not take away from the anger at the occupation. That does not take away from any of the other motivating factors. But it does dilute the potential for a focused mass movement that is capable of overthrowing the government. That provides us with no opportunity to decapitate the insurgency. We cannot kill Zarqawi and end the insurgency, and I think that's obviously, that's been publicly stated. However, the insurgency has very little potential, the Sunni insurgency has very little potential to create any kind of genuine threat to the central government as long as the U.S. forces remain in the country. And that, I think that's absolutely critical to understand. So as long as we continue to keep the insurgency somewhat at bay, the political development that both Matt and Phoebe talked about is possible. And I agree that Basra is certainly going to be a considerable challenge, as is Ramadi and other places. I helped put together the plan that we're employing in Ramadi right now. I want to talk a bit about the population, and then I'll wrap up. We have the insurgency has morphed into primarily an AQI-related insurgency. That means that these criminals, these small groups, even groups that are directly opposed to AQI, are in some way related with them because that's where the money comes from. That's where the money flows through. AQI has, in general, insurgents that have labeled themselves as AQI in many cases because they're criminals, because they conduct violent criminal behavior, have alienated the vast majority of the population. When I had discussions with Iraqi sheikhs and political leaders in 2004, the primary thrust of the discussion was, we want the Americans out. When are you leaving? When is the occupation going to end? You have to withdraw from Ramadi, Fallujah, etc. That has now shifted. Because of this alienation, because of the recognition amongst the populace that the insurgency is primarily a criminal enterprise, the major thrust of the conversations that I have now with these folks is, we need more troops. How long are you going to stay? Please don't abandon us. And when are you going to do something about AQI? That's a dramatic shift. And again, that presents some opportunities for us. We talked about the potential for a strong leader. I just kind of piqued my interest there because there was a couple of quotes that matched up that struck me as important. One was from General Kelly when we were in Tikrit in 2003 trying to put together a government there. And he said, there are no George Washingtons in this country. Certainly lots of folks willing to risk their lives and have done so and lost them. Fallujah City Council notes, early 2006, one of the Fallujah City Council members, there are no George Washingtons in this country. Direct quote. Matched exactly what our observation was in 2003. Again, this is a very nebulous situation. I think that anybody that's tried to codify it, break it apart, delineate it in any way is probably painting a picture that doesn't exist. So I'll leave you with that, the fog of war, and look forward to some questions.
Thank you very much, Ben, Matt, and Phoebe.
I should at least get up.
We have a microphone over on this side of the room, and I'll invite questioners to come to the microphone. Tell us who you are and pose your question.
Yes, my name is Raf Haley. I'm with the Memory Middle East Media Research Institute. I start with one comment to General major carnival, maybe a general in the future, a major carnival in that there is indeed a change in the attitude of the Sunnis in Al-Anbar and elsewhere, not so much because of the criminal enterprise that you mentioned, but I think the Sunnis are very much concerned about the penetration of Iran into Iraq. They want the American presence in Iraq to forestall that penetration. And I have a question to speaker about Basra, a city which I know very well. I lived there for many, many years of my life. Now, the question of Basra, you mentioned the conflict in Basra. I was surprised you did not mention anything about the stirrings by Iran in Basra. After all, the Fadila party is a party which is financed by Iran. It is engaged in oil smuggling in collaboration with Iran. The militia of Fadila party, which is called Harakat Tharallah, the movement of Allah's revenge, is financed and trained by Iran. So you can't really divorce the issue of Basra from what Iran is doing in that part of Iraq. Thank you.
Thank you. Who wants to take on Iran?
That's absolutely right. I mean, I was speaking in specifically about the insurgency, but the fear of Iran amongst the Sunnis can't be overestimated. A quote from a guy that I was working with, a sheikh that I was working with there, his mother, when she wanted him to get him to brush his teeth at night, she used to say, if you don't brush your teeth, the Iranians will get you. That's very true. And they see that threat rising with the dominance of a Shia government in Baghdad.
Phoebe, did you find concern about this?
I found it even earlier, as you'll recall, because I was trying to sort of lop off one portion of my studies to focus on Sunnis and nationalists as a whole. And very early on, I found this shift as much as 6 months ago in talking to people in Amman. Many of the Sunnis that I'm talking to, I think, have some kind of roots in the insurgency. They don't say so, but, you know, they've got tribal connections. They're sitting in Amman. It was clear that their attitude was changing. Nobody's happy about occupation. Obviously, they would like to end this as soon as possible, however you define that. But their fear really was increasing Iranian influence. They were trying to make a distinction, at least with me, between saying all Shia are pro-Iranian. They did not think that, but they were worried about certain parties, certain evidence of Shiism. I think there's another reason why they're more leery about our rapid departure, and that is that they're now not only marginalized, but as this violence morphs into sectarian violence in Baghdad, they're under attack. And they need protection. So I would certainly go along with that. I think we need to take a closer look at the Fadila party, like the Sudras movement and all of these groups. I'm sure that Iran is you know, funding, hedging its bets and funding everything. But these parties all have very distinctive identities now, and Fadila and Sudra in particular, although they are penetrated by some Iranians, make quite a point about being Iraqi parties. So it's a little more ambiguous, I think.
Matt?
Let me just say I absolutely concur that Iran should have been included in my comments about Basra, because they do play an instrumental role in what and how they're able to kind of orchestrate things down there. I think it's also important that you start seeing government officials coming out and saying much more about Iran and also their involvement. A great interview, a great press conference that was given a week ago was by General Casey with Secretary of Defense, where the general laid out the four primary security threats to the country: Al-Qaeda, armed criminal groups, which is termed for militias, Sunni on Shia violence, and also Iran. And the general went into more detail than I've seen any before in unclassified reports of him going into how he saw them interfering and their training type of routes and things of that such. So absolutely, it's a big issue. With regards to Fadila, I completely agree. The governor particularly has been accused a lot with regards to smuggling issues, oil smuggling and things of that such. And what's also made things difficult for Maliki is that the oil minister used to be a member of the Fadila party, who then was replaced by Sharistani. So this has caused another type of rub between Maliki and the Fadila Party, and I think there's other types of retribution that's coming on because of that.
Rob?
Hi, Rob Henderson, Center for the Study of the Presidency. Welcome back to the U.S., man. I have a question for the panel, and I don't want to get anybody in trouble, but I'd like to talk about you know, conditions of tribal warfare here in Washington, D.C. Has interagency cooperation, coordination, I don't know, communication, maybe we can get back to just contact. We may not have a George Washington in Iraq, but do we have a George Marshall in the U.S. government who can actually provide guidance, clarity to deliver the sorts of things that Ben was talking about? For goodness sakes, it seems like there's maybe even an economic and social political development component to the problems in Anbar. Goodness gracious, where have we heard that before? Well, we heard it 4 years ago here at the Institute of Peace. I heard a lot of people talk about it. Where do you think, I don't mean to, you know, preempt the whole discussion by going above everybody's pay grade, but the idea is, okay, there's some real needs. Is there anyone who would like to?
I'm tempted to ask Matt first, being a civilian who worked in Iraq and being in the private sector.
That's
now.
That's right. part of it, I'll just compliment some comments that Ben said, is saying there's only three people or five people from the State Department that are out there right now. That's a huge problem. You need to have more civilians involved in this. One of the big problems that you have with regards to training of police forces, the military's taking it over. Why are they? Because the civilians aren't stepping up to the bat enough. You need to have civilians be able to be involved in certain parts of the reconstruction process, but they simply aren't able to provide the numbers or quality individuals to do it. Why is that? And that's because, in my opinion, the interagency process is broken significantly. It's something where you're just not able to move resources quick enough in order to deal with problems that are paramount, or even to be able to be preemptive and go out and be able to do things out in the field that are necessary so they don't become big problems. I'm of the opinion that what you need is another type of Goldwater-Nichols type of bill, but one that kind of expands throughout the entire interagency process. And this is something that is a multi-10-year-plus type of effort, but it's something that's necessary if you're going to be able to do reconstruction or preventative types of measures so you don't have another type of situation like Iraq. I've always thought in the 100-to-1 principle, you can have a military intervention which is 100 times more expensive than having a diplomatic preventative type of measure. And if you're able to focus on that, on the latter, you're then able to kind of not have the types of situations that we have right now within Iraq. But to be able to do that, you have to have a strong interagency where you have all elements of government that come together in order to focus on those issues. And you don't have that right now.
Ben, you pointed out the problem. Any solutions?
Yeah, I think that's the third time I've heard the mention of a new Goldwater-Nichols type act to try to create some kind of deployable, joint, combined military-civilian organization that can work in these kind of environments. I think that's one of the big problems. I was extraordinarily critical of the State Department for not sending people over to fill these available billets in El Anbar province, and of the CPA for not pushing people out into the provinces when they took over. And then I talked to some State Department folks, and I've come to realize over time that the State Department is just not built to deploy people. That's not how they work. Almost every State Department Foreign Service officer is working in a mission somewhere or in an embassy. So there has to be some kind of bureaucratic and structural change if we're going to be able to fill all these posts. You can't force State Department people to deploy. So, I mean, there has to be some kind of unit or organization where people know they're going to be deployed and put them in there. I don't think this is something we can solve overnight, unfortunately, other than try to encourage people to come on out and visit Ramadi.
I would like to yes, put please. My two cents in on this one. I'd like to say something good about this. There may be a lot of problems in government and interagency disputes. We're all familiar with that. I don't think this is one of them. I think there's another problem out there since we're talking about reality in the ground that is stunning to me every time I go out. Let me preface it by saying one good thing, however, in terms of coordination. I think the ambassador, Khalilzad, is doing about as well as anybody could do out there. I think he's got a sort of vision and a sense of feel for things on the ground that is quite good and quite remarkable. And, you know, at his level, I think there's a good deal of at least intellectual coordination. But I have the feeling he's kind of out on the limb there with, you know, inadequate staff to do the job. Now, the reason I think you don't get people going out there, and I'd like some reaction here, is that it's just plain too dangerous. It's too awful. It's too physically wearing. Maybe you can go out to Anbar. I'd love to do that in terms of my research, but that is like going to the moon as far as I'm concerned. I wouldn't be allowed to do it, neither State Department, the military, anybody else would allow me to go out there and do that research. Neither is the State Department or most of the other people out there. You have to go out there and understand what it takes to get from the airport into the green zone, what it takes to make a visit out from the green zone to anyone else, and that includes not just the Americans who are working there, but also many of the government officials who are working in the green zone. This is the most abnormal situation, perhaps outside of North Korea, that I think exists anywhere. Partly it's for security, because you can't get people to come. And while I know a lot of people who are asked to come, quality people are not going out because they have better offers. And this also affects the quality of people you get. So can people actually go to Anbar and do the job? Or Hilla? That's a question.
Yeah.
I have the unusual pleasure of a State Department officer who'd like to comment. So, Bob Deutsch.
If I may, I'm Bob Deutsch. I'm the Deputy Senior Advisor to the Secretary on Iraq, or have been for the last year. Let me start off by saying that who we have in Iraq and what they're doing is in response to what Ambassador Khalilzad recommends. 84% on average, 84% of the positions that have been established in Iraq are filled and being completed by the people, by State Department officers, by State Department contractors throughout the year, on an average throughout the year. Our experience, I think that DOD's experience, since it's taken over MOI and MOD on the civilian side, isn't any better. So they have no better capability, and they make it up to a certain extent by putting military officers into civilian positions, something that we don't quite have the luxury to do. 84%, given the way the State Department rotates people, actually is probably not too far from the average of what our missions in non-dangerous places are filled in terms of the turnover rate. So let me just say that about staffing. If there are only three, there are very few positions in Anbar for civilians. For, as Phoebe said, it requires a lot of security resources to support, and other kinds of resources to support any civilian, particularly in Anbar. I also wanted to comment a little bit on the issues related to interagency coordination on Iraq issues, and also this idea that somehow the U.S. government fails in the way it responds to crisis situations. I think the interagency coordination, over my experience here in Washington over the last year, has been very good. I think we have an interagency coordination process that starts in Baghdad, where Ambassador Khalilzad and General Casey, as they say repeatedly, are linked at the hip. They talk regularly. They plan regularly. As you look at the embassy's planning process, which has been beefed up over the last year, something that Ambassador Khalilzad wanted to do, and you look at General Casey's campaign plan and his planning process, you see increasing integration. And I think that's reflected also in the work that we're doing back here to support them. But it really is true, and I think we've heard pieces of that in the discussions today, that the economic, the political, and the security are truly interlinked. And while Ben said that there's nothing in the insurgency that could effectively overthrow the government, what the insurgency does do that could undermine the government is prevent it from demonstrating its credibility and its effectiveness, because we see that every day. And one thing that we haven't mentioned about in the ground truth is that in the 6 weeks or so that this new government has been in place, they have, with our support, managed to increase significantly oil exports, which will make a major difference over the long term in their ability to fund their operations, and have also managed to increase the electricity availability, which is at now, I think, at for much of the winter, it was at 3 or 4 hours in Baghdad, and it is now approaching 12 hours in Baghdad, and we're at generation and transmission levels throughout the country that are exceeding 2005, which is a very big increase and something that the Prime Minister put a major emphasis on. A little bit more theoretically, and I'll stop quickly because I don't want to monopolize the floor. A little bit more theoretically, how does the U.S. respond to this kind of, let's call it what by its bad name, nation building? There's a trade-off between a CPA kind of situation where we're running everything and we have lots of people, and getting out of the way and being supportive and letting the Iraqis run their country and make their decisions so that they can develop the technical capability and the experience. We have to rely to a certain extent on the embassy and MNFI to tell us, and the Iraqis to tell us, what that balance is, and that's what we're staffing to. But in general, we don't have a colonial office in the United States, and the kind of, when I hear the criticisms of the civilian side of the government, that the State Department doesn't have a whole bunch of police trainers that we can send out, that we don't have a whole bunch of people who know how to run electricity companies, who know how to run oil companies. The Department of Energy doesn't have people to send out who run oil companies. We don't have a colonial office. And if we're going to do nation building in Iraq or elsewhere, we're going to need one. And that's what and I agree that is a decision. The Secretary of State has made some decisions that we're going to move the Foreign Service in directions with her transformational diplomacy in that direction. But it would have to be a larger U.S. government decision that we're going to do that, which has all sorts of bureaucracy, fiscal implications that I'm not sure that we're prepared to bite off on. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Let me take two people. We have a long line, so we're going to have to hasten people a bit.
Okay. Patty Friedman, America's Development Foundation. The situation for women in Iraq is precarious and deteriorating daily. I would be curious to hear from all the panelists on both thoughts and solutions on addressing the issues.
Please.
Aaron Sheldon, Senator Jeffords' office. One of the big debates on the Hill right now is the ability of Iraqi security forces to take over from American forces, and the difficult information here is determining that actual ability. You talked a little bit about the numbers, and I'd be interested to hear on both the national and local level, how credible are the Iraqi forces? What is their ability to really take over from Americans in the local situations and national situations, and what are some of the concerns about infiltration of the Iraqi forces, such that they look good, but in reality are not functioning to serve national ends?
Let me offer those questions to the panel. Women and the ability of the Iraqi forces.
I'll say something about women, because I'm not going to say anything about the forces. it depends on how we view the whole women's situation. I think the situation for many people, not all people in Iraq, is precarious because of the security situation. Can't send the kids to school. It's not safe. Women are affected just as much as men by those circumstances, which do not prevail, incidentally, in the entire country. Now, what people usually mean by women is perhaps veiling limitations and so on. I agree that there seems to be a good bit more of let's say, enforced behavior of that kind, not just on women, but on men as well, which many people, especially secular Western-educated people, complain to me about. The more sophisticated people would like to see a choice. Women want to wear the hijab, fine. If they don't, that's fine, too. Let me just say, I find a debate about this among the leading political figures, and there will be an argument for as long as we can see in the future about the space between religion and the state. And that argument, I think, will go on, and that's okay. The real problem lies with the militias on the ground. It's those folks in Basra, in parts of Baghdad, and so on, who are, arbitrarily enforcing these things, much to the consternation of everyone. So it seems to me that getting a rule of law, getting a legitimate professional police system is part of this problem, as well as many others.
How close are we to having credible Iraqi forces, Ben?
Closer than you think. I mean, we've still got quite some time to go. You can't build an army from nothing overnight, and that's what we're doing. It's going to take some time. I think that's been said. I mean, again, at this point, I need to throw out my disclaimer that I don't represent the views of the United States government or the United States Marine Corps. But there was an article by Greg Jaffe in the Wall Street Journal last week. He described a very, very difficult relationship between some American colonels and the guys that are working with the Iraqis. They're called MITs, military transition teams. We have BITs, border transition teams, PITs, et cetera, for the police. Things are going well in El Anbar province. Again, I can only speak for El Anbar. We've got army units operating on the ground with their own territory that they've assumed control of. They are conducting missions on a daily basis independently, conducting the missions independently from direct control from Americans. They require our logistics support, and that's not going to go away for some time. It's very difficult to maintain, develop, first of all, and then maintain logistics agencies and efficient logistics agencies, especially in a country as corrupt and criminal as Iraq is right now. And I think that's the greatest challenge. We're going to have a lot of capable forces on the ground that are capable of taking over terrain. We're going to continue to turn over this terrain to the Iraqis, but that requirement for our support is going to exist for quite some time. We are going to continue to push these transition teams out with the Iraqi forces, and I think that's probably going to be our greatest opportunity for success. We've got officers and staff NCOs out with the Iraqis, running patrols, teaching them, working with them, living with them, eating their food, and doing all the things that have been recommended by every counterinsurgency expert to come out of the woodwork in the last 3 years. That is happening, and that is happening with great success. In El Anbar, I think less so right now, perhaps in the Shia areas because of the militia issues. But certainly we have a much stronger Iraqi military now than we did in 2004. When you remember what happened when they tried to respond to the first Fallujah action in April.
Matt,
Just a few points. One on with regards to women. Just one quick point that I heard yesterday. It was that the 2-year anniversary for the transition of sovereignty from CPA to the Alawi government, which was yesterday, I'm sure you all know. Ambassador Bremer was there, and he gave a few comments. And one of the comments he gave was about the number of women that are in the workforce. And I think that the statistic that he gave out was that there's a third more women in the workforce than at the end of than during the regime. So he was laying out a number of successes. I don't know where he came with the statistic, but that's what he mentioned, I recall. With regards to security forces, it's important that we get away from the numbers of security forces that are constantly trained and equipped. I think that really is a hollow number. What the greatest challenges that Minsticky faces, and us, the government faces as well, is finding capable leaders. Leadership is the big, big issue there. Whether you're able to get people, police chiefs, local police chiefs, military commanders, brigade commanders, battalions, whether you're able to kind of get these people that go through the training programs, but then whether they have someone who's there that's then going to follow the rule of law, that's going to get and implement policies and things of that such. And that's always been the big sticking point that I've seen in our development of the security forces. With regards to the timing, I think you're going to start to see a real transition happen over the course of the next 9 to 18 months. You saw last month that the Monthana province was transferred or was announced to be transferred over in July. Granted, that's not a province of great significance with regards to insurgency or anything like that, but it's a step. And it shows that there is a process that's in place. There are conditions that have been developed, and that this is going to then be duplicated throughout the rest of the provinces throughout the country over the course of the coming months and years. And so you're going to start to see this, and you're going to start to see just growing confidence in security forces. One element that we always also forget about is the element of time and experience on the ground. And we talk about the training and equipping, and that's fine. But again, it's just the experience that these forces and these individuals learn on the ground, being on the beat, being in the battlefield. And there's nothing else that can replace that. No, lots of times the Iraqis think their skill level is equivalent to the size of their gun. No. It's the time on the beat. It's time in the battlefield. It's a time interaction. It's time working. And that will come about as, again, we transition over parts of the country.
Let me take three people quickly.
Hi, I'm Noah Hertzbunzel from the International Crisis Group. I'm interested in Kirkuk and the de-Arabization process leading up to the referendum that's supposed to happen by the end of 2007, both for Article 140 of the Constitution and going back to Article 58 of the transitional document, what your thoughts are on that and whether it's going to be implemented according to schedule.
My name is Jeff Friedman. I'm from the Council on Foreign Relations. My question is about what do you think the impact of the security forces getting stronger will be in Iraq? We've heard that the insurgency is criminal, and therefore perhaps we need a strong central Leviathan, as Mr. Sherman said, in Iraq. But we've also heard that it's predominantly Sunni, and therefore a strong central government led by Shiites could exacerbate communal security dilemmas in the country. So what do you believe, or do you believe, that indigenous security forces can adequately address sectarian tensions in Iraq?
Hi, Eric Gustafson with the Education for Peace in Iraq Center. I have one question specifically for the major about Ramadi. There were reports, I believe it was late last year, about some tribal leaders actually negotiating an arrangement so that more of their members could join the security forces. And then there was the attack on the recruiting station where even some of the leaders were killed. If you could just talk about that and where things are at with that. And then a question for the full panel. As an indicator of success in terms of these security forces coming online, has there been any polling looking at the trust that Iraqis are placing in those security forces? And I know from some of my Iraqi friends cases where they will go to the American troops rather than going to the security forces because out of fear that the information or who they are might be sold to insurgents. Thanks.
Okay, we've got Kirkuk and whether we can really expect a referendum in 2007. We've got the question of whether stronger security forces won't create problems of their own. And we've got the question of trust in the security forces as well as the specific question about Ramadi. You want to start with Ramadi, Ben?
Sure, yeah. I'm fairly comfortable with Ramadi, and I know the history. I know a lot of the key players personally. There were considerable negotiations, not only in Ramadi, but across the province, with also some tribes that have crossover into the other provinces as well, to bring recruits into the security forces in late 2005 and then again in early 2006, and that's ongoing today. Those negotiations were very successful in some regards, not successful in others. Again, it's an extraordinarily complex environment out there, and whenever we enter into negotiations, we tend to make fools of ourselves. So it was a miracle that we pulled this off in the first place. But we did get a tremendous number of folks, specifically from the Abu Nimr tribe, to show up at the glass factory in downtown Ramadi in January. January 5th, there was a suicide vest attack on the glass factory recruiting station that killed anywhere between 35 and 70, depending on which hospital reports you believe, Iraqi recruits. The remarkable thing about this suicide bombing was that the recruits who survived the attack, including some who were fairly grievously wounded, stood back up and got back in line to sign up. That's quite something, especially if you'd seen the pictures of the scene after the bombing. We lost two Americans and a military working dog in that attack as well. It was quite gruesome, and the Iraqi unbelievable ability to withstand bloodshed and death rejoin the line. Quite a different situation than I think you would have seen in 2003 and 2004. These are some folks that are not only looking for money and a job, but are truly dedicated to establishing some kind of security. They're tired, I think, of the security situation being as it is. The fear prevents a lot of them from joining the security forces, but I think that we've reached a point now where there's a genuine interest to be involved, and that explains the response to the bombing in Ramadi.
Phoebe, I'm tempted to turn to you on this question of will a stronger central government and stronger security forces really be welcomed by the Sunni community, which has asked for it repeatedly?
Yeah, the question is how many Sunnis are going to be in it? Are they going to be in the military? I will try to address that, but I have a question to ask my military colleagues on that. To me, the security situation stretches over several different kinds of forces. There's the army, which should be a multi-ethnic, multi-sectarian force if it's going to be national, and it's not clear to me. I'd like to hear the extent to which actually that's being accomplished. And you could send that army to the border in a Sunni area or Shia area or whatever because it was a national army. I still keep hearing from Sunnis that they certainly want a stronger central government, they want a professional army, and they want to participate in that army. And I understand they are signing up for it and so on. The only proviso I would put here, both in terms of this national army and in terms of dismantling or doing something about militias, which may have more to do with police and local security in your area, is I think this is a critical issue of trust in the national government. And I keep having these conversations with people who are involved in security on the Shia side, who are really fearful of an army in which the military, for example, one of them said to me, you don't want to put a military man, a man with military experience, a general and so on, in the Ministry of Defense because they may bring in all these military people and they may make a coup. That might sound like a throwback to the old Iraq, but the fear is very there. So I think both on the militias, disarming the militias, which is the basis of support for many of these people in power on the Shia side, and how to construct this army and integrate Shia is going to be a matter of trust and reconciliation. It's going to be a slow process. Kirkuk, just a quick answer on this. I did have a couple of conversations with Kurds and raise this issue. That is still, of course, at the top of their agenda, that this should proceed on schedule. But there was some, wistfulness about saying nobody's talking about it anymore. Everything else has come to the fore. Things are getting postponed and delayed. So I'm just wondering whether, in fact, that might not happen with Kirkuk as well. Personally, I think the more you can postpone some of these things until you can knit things together a little better might not be a bad idea, but I don't know.
I see Matt nodding yes.
I completely agree with that. Giving time in order to kind of let the dust settle in some areas would be a godsend. With just quickly on the constitutional referendum or the constitutional renegotiations, Kirkuk will be the key there. How they're going to divvy up oil revenues and also how they're going to define federalism. I see the two big areas of being, actually again, it'll be a Shia type of discussion that'll be going on. You have a bloc that follows Sistani quite a bit that believes that we need to kind of keep a more centralized government type of system because they've achieved success in these elections. They have control in many of the areas in Baghdad apparatus. Why should we give that up? While then Abdulaziz Hakim and his group thinks that we need a much more clearly delineated federalist model. So it'll be interesting to see how that negotiation goes on within the Shia ranks. With regards to Kirkuk, again, that's another area that it'll be interesting to see what type of ground the Kurds are going to give or going to take. They have this very fine line that they have to walk, in my opinion. And it's one side is where they finally have kind of really achieved much of the power they've always looked for, besides having their own autonomous area. But they finally have the presidency. They finally have deputy prime ministership. They finally have other parts of important institutes, ministries within government. They really have a say within Baghdad. But if they overplay their hand too much, they could lose a lot of that. Having said that, if they become too successful, they may then have to be the region that has to carry much of the rest of the country if they're able to kind of have lots of the revenues that come from Kirkuk. So it'll be interesting to see how they walk that balance. Security forces, quick point. With regards to the long term, this is a long term issue that I've always seen to be a potential problem, is with regards to the Ministry of Interior and Ministry of Defense confrontations. What you have right now is a situation where the Ministry of Defense is really taking the lead a lot in many of the security operations. And this is causing a lot of problems from the Ministry of Interior perspective, from the police. The police are saying, you're the defense. You're supposed to handle external threats. We're interior. We're supposed to handle the internal threats. And I think if you, as we transition over more and more provinces, if they first go to the military and the police see this as a constant threat and they see this happen time and time again, you may start to see greater divisiveness or greater types of confrontations between the police and between the army through other areas of the country. So this will be something, again, to look for, not any time in the near or medium term, but could be a potential problem in the long term. With regards to the points on how the different security forces are viewed and how the MNFI is viewed by the people and the confidence level, a great poll was done by IRI in March, which addresses this exact issue and breaks it down by region and I think also by some cities, how certain people view the police, view the military, view MNFI, view the militias, view the insurgents, who they go to, who they rely on, who they trust. And it's really good. I believe it might be on their website. If not, then you can come back up to me afterwards and I'll email it to you because I've looked at it and used it before in my other discussions and talks.
On the security force issue and answer your question, also the other ones as well. I mean, there's tremendous differences between the recruiting for the Army and recruiting for the police. The vast majority of the young men out in Alambar province want to be members of the police force for several reasons. First and foremost, because they won't have to move. They're very family oriented. They want to be near their families, and they're reluctant to join an organization that may take them away from home. We're having tremendous problems paying their salaries, because we've turned that over to the Iraqis, and this is my personal opinion, a bit early. We're not doing a great job paying these folks. So there's no guarantee that they're going to get paid, and there's no central banking system. So when they do get paid, we have to put these huge convoys together and drive them, in some cases, from Al-Qaim out on the Syrian border all the way back to, say, Mosul, where some of these folks are from, in order to give the money back to their families. See their families for a couple of days and then drive them back, which is an extremely difficult and dangerous thing to do. There's more of an ability for the Shia, who are stronger politically and tribally, to encourage their young men to join the army than amongst the Sunni in the Sunni Triangle, because the tribal system in the Sunni Triangle is, for all intents and purposes, broken, which is a whole other issue. But they don't have the coercive power that a lot of the Shia do. There is some fear of Shia discrimination, but I would say, again, all politics are local here. I mean, if you look at Al-Qaim, where it used to be one of the worst places in Alambar province, is now one of the most settled. The people are very accepting of the army, which is primarily Shia. You look at Fallujah, they're very accepting of the army. However, you look at two different units in Fallujah, and we talked about leadership being so critical. The leader of the 2nd Brigade is a very aggressive guy, and folks tend not to like the 2nd Brigade because they're too aggressive. The leader of the 4th Brigade is a very congenial guy. Everybody seems to love the 4th Brigade. Both of these units are primarily Shia. There's very little difference between the two of them other than the personalities of their commanders and the behavior of the troops. The reactions are totally different. So there is no easy answer to the are the security forces being accepted question. I'd say generally things are improving.
Let me take just three more. We have to give up the room promptly at 11, so I think I'm only going to have time for three more. Please.
Jonathan Powers, Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation. About a month ago, a team leader on one of our landmine impact surveys was injured when an improvised bomb exploded near his taxi. Out of curiosity, what is the Iraqi military doing to take care of landmines and other improvised explosive ordnance that's been placed prior to the liberation of Iraq?
Please, let me take two more.
Hafsa Zarouk from Al Mustaqbal Arabi magazine. My question can be answered by any of the panelists. If I'm not wrong, I remember Major Ben saying that the political development and security stability in Iraq can be achieved if the detrimental actions of the insurgents are harnessed. Now, with the death of the third defense lawyer, Saddam Hussein, many international red experts see it as a failure for the U.S. to provide security in Iraq, and a further evidence that the American version of democracy might be an illusion hard to implement in a failed environment. Any responses to that? Thanks.
My name is Hala Al-Sharaf. I'm an Iraqi Fulbrighter currently in the U.S. doing health policy. I have two questions, please. One of them is related to the decentralization policy and whether we have all governorates at equitable distribution of human resources, infrastructure, and economics. And my worry is that if they are so decentralized, are we going to have gaps between level of performance, and that will bring insurgency back? The other question is related to the role of the religious leaders within a Shia government when we have different parties following different marja'iyah, as we have in the Shia system. We have role for the Sistanis and other leaders, some of them in Iraq, some of them are outside Iraq. And the minute we see the prime minister coming up with an initiative, then we see a feedback coming from one marja or the other calling for a different action. So how far can we succeed in bringing the religious leaders towards a political role and place some role into reconciliation? Thank you very much.
Well, we have four questions, I think, on the table about religious leaders and their role, about decentralization and the uneven capacities for it around the country, about the democratic illusion. Is it an illusion for Iraqis? And then about, I take it to mean small arms that were, have become widely available in the Iraqi population. What can be done about that? Let me go through the panel in reverse order of from the initial speaking.
I got your question. Yeah.
You got it?
That wasn't what I meant at all.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm fine.
Yeah. You want to focus on landmines, IEDs, and landmines specifically. Okay.
I would say landmines are not a big problem in Iraq. They were not widely planted, possibly some on the Iranian border, but we haven't had a major problem with landmines. IEDs are a different story, but they're perishable. They need to be monitored, and they need to be triggered. I would say that that's not going to be the kind of lasting problem you see in Cambodia and elsewhere. And on the democracy issue, I'll quote Saeb Erekat, anybody that believes Arabs can't achieve democracy is a racist.
Matt?
I don't know about the landmine issue, so I defer to Ben on that issue. With regards to the unevenness of the economic development, I completely agree with that question. It really is an issue. I'm not an expert on economic development. I'm not someone who looked at a lot of how revenues are dispersed throughout the country. But it's something where, again, it gets to the point that I was raising before of how the Kurds are a bit more advanced with regards to where they are economically, where they are, and also from a security perspective, and whether then that would then cause them to have to carry other parts of the country. You're seeing also the Sunni areas now, it's going to take years in order for them to kind of become more self-sustaining, and how that then going to continue to develop when then the Shias are going to gain control of the major port within Iraq, and how they're then able to use that for their own economic development or own political. So it's all very disjointed, and I don't believe that revenues are dispersed equally among the 18 provinces.
Phoebe?
Yeah. First, on democracy, it depends what components. It's sort of like a third rail. I think you have democracy in Iraq. You've had elections. Not everybody is entirely pleased with some of the results of them and how they were conducted. But you've certainly had more democracy, more freedom of the press now. And this gets to the uneven development. My advice and my thinking on this, and I don't think it's unusual, is that you've had a lot of development of democracy and participation and so on. What the Iraqis need now is governance. They really need to work on government capacity. That's certainly true at the central level, pulling the new elected government together, getting a civil service, making ministries work, dealing with corruption, trying to monopolize force in the hands of government, legitimate government. And they need governments not only at the central level, but they also need it at the provincial level, however that's going to be defined regionally and otherwise. It's very disparate now. It is too decentralized, if you want to use that term, because militias are running around and so on. The Kurdish experiment, which is seen as very successful in Iraq now, they've got more security, more economic development, et cetera, is exercising a pull on other regions. That's one of the things that you see. It's not just Basra and elsewhere, but there's a real imbalance here between a region that is perceived to be doing well and others which are not. But whether it's at the central level, and there needs to be more cohesive central government, there also needs to be better governance at the local level. The role of religious leaders, as I said, is going to be contentious within the Shia community. There may be a number of Marja'iyya. It seems to me Sistani is playing a very critical role here, not only himself, but sort of setting a model for what might emerge as the dominant model for Iraqi, what shall we say, influence in the political system. I found a wide disparate views on talking to Shia. Some want, some very secular people do not want much. They want a separation of mosque and state. Most of the Shia political leaders in the parties take a somewhat different point of view. They said that they want a quietist religious view. They certainly want religious leaders to play a role in society, influencing things, in particular in times of crisis, read today. If they need to step in, as Sistani seems to do from time to time, that's just fine. Others, Fadila, maybe Sadrist movement, maybe some others, are much closer to redefining Wilayat al-Faqih, that is the rule of the clergy, and so on. So this is all under argument, to say nothing of how much Sharia should be accepted in the constitution and in personal status law. So I would look to see individual Shia following their marja as usual, but this whole issue of the role of the clergy in the state and religion in society is going to be one that is going to be debated. And actually, I think democratically in Iraq, it's going to be interesting to watch. Nobody can predict exactly where it's going to come out.
Let me just add one other last point about economic development and also tie it to the involvement that the U.S. must continue to assist on this. Just to put in a bit of a historical perspective to Vietnam, not to say the conflicts are anywhere like one another, but to regards to the conclusion of Vietnam, I'm of the opinion that we didn't necessarily lose Vietnam in 73 when the troops left the country. We lost it in 75 when the economic development and the funding stopped, and we stopped supporting them that way. And I don't think we want to make that same mistake again. I see you shaking your head, but I don't think we want to make that same mistake again. And that's the reason why I think we will remain engaged in Iraq, particularly through economic assistance, for many years to come, beyond the years of, that we have troops on the ground.
Well, I want to thank the panel very much. I think they have done exactly what we had hoped, which was to give us a much more nuanced view of the situation in Iraq, and I hope you'll join me in thanking them.
Thank you.